This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, June 2nd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Yesterday, President Trump announced that the United States will withdraw from the Paris Accord, the 2015 agreement on climate change.
The Paris Agreement handicaps the United States economy in order to win praise from the very foreign capitals and global activists that have long sought to gain wealth at our country's expense. They don't put America first. I do, and I always will.
Brian Lissa joins me to discuss the emerging Trump doctrine as manifested in his Rose Garden announcement, his recent trip to the Middle East and Europe, and the latest revelations about the administration's attempts to cultivate ties to President Putin's Russia. Ryan, hi.
Hi.
Despite all the speculative drama that led up to this announcement, his decision was not a surprise, and it's one of the few subjects that Trump has been utterly consistent on since the beginning of his campaign.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it would have been more surprising if he had listened to Rex Tillerson, his Secretary of State, his daughter Ivanka, his son-in-law Jared Kushner, and had actually stayed in the accord. Because this has been a very consistent campaign promise that he would pull out of the Paris Accord. We talk a lot about the debate in the White House being between the so-called nationalists and the globalists, right? And for shorthand's sake, it's the nationalists and Steve Bannon, and the globalists and Jared Kushner, or sometimes Gary Cohn, the economic advisor. The nationalists tend to win when they are aligned with the broader Republican Party. So in some sense, this was a easy win for them. The entire Republican leadership supported Trump canceling this. Paul Ryan sent out a statement praising him. His vice president was on board with this. The entire donor class of the Republican Party, that's not to say all of corporate America, there's plenty of corporate America that thought this was a stupid decision, but the people that really matter, the Koch brothers and the Mercers, they all supported withdrawing from this. So obviously Trump has views that put him at odds with many Republicans, especially on trade and immigration. But on this is a Republican Party position, not a Donald Trump.
But Wall Street, ExxonMobil, even Peabody Coal, for that matter, Mitt Romney issued, not that he's, you know, the voice of the party anymore, but he issued a statement last week. So there are many forces within the Republican Party that actually oppose withdrawing from the agreement.
That's true. But I always look to Congress and to see how many actual, you know, members of the House and Senate. This is the best way to sort of gauge what the party really believes. How many Republicans have modern views on climate change? And there just aren't very many. And most of the conservative movement is aligned against doing much of anything on climate change, even though in recent years, probably the most significant change has been that a lot of conservatives have now come around to the fact that it's a real thing, and that man may be partly responsible for it. The new argument is, well, it's all too expensive to deal with, and these international treaties don't do anything.
He seems to approach diplomacy, even with our closest allies, as if it were a perilous contest between competitors. This feels like foreign policy by spite.
Yeah, I mean, I think one telling anecdote in the newspapers today is the Washington Post reports that a senior White House official told the Post that a, quote, secondary benefit, end quote, of withdrawing from the Paris Accord was that it angered the French president. And why did Trump specifically want to anger him? Well, because of the famous handshake that the two of them had, and that the French president publicly said that he gave Trump such a vigorous handshake on purpose. There's a long pattern of this, but now the ramifications now are kind of enormous of Trump's own personal narcissism and slights against him personally, that he's taking that into consideration when making such a momentous decision like this.
So what about the speech itself?
Yeah. And you know, Dorothy, my job for you is always to be a reporter first and not to editorialize too much. But I mean, that speech was a pack of lies. It was the worst most deceitful speech since his inaugural address. He talked about the accord as if it was some economic disaster for the United States. It's a non-binding voluntary agreement. So when Trump says, I'm going to renegotiate a better deal, well, that's a lie. That's just not possible. If you wanted to renegotiate our position within the Paris Accord, you could change the promises that Obama made. It's also non-binding. If you decided we weren't going to meet the limits that Obama promised we would meet, there's really no penalty. And as immediately, several European countries put out a statement, which is kind of shocking and sad, that you know they have to put out a statement opposing a major decision of the United States that said, sorry, we will not be renegotiating this. That's not part of the deal. And so I think aside from just the climate effects here, it just sends a signal that we don't honor our commitments.
And the other thing that struck me was his question, rhetorical question, you know, at what point does America get demeaned? At what point do they start laughing at us as a country? And that is just such an odd but also revealing set of questions, which also marked his speech in Europe about NATO. He seems to be driven by this conviction that the U.S. is constantly being cheated.
And that's what is so different about him from any recent American president, maybe not some American politicians, but recent American presidents. He's not willing to defend to a sometimes skeptical public the importance of America's role in the world and commitments in the world, and instead caricatures them. I mean, that's why you can't escape the kind of sad fact that this was politically motivated, that he is facing right now the low point in his presidency where his disapproval, even among his most important supporters, is starting to crack. The Russia investigation is widening, and his agenda on Capitol Hill is stalled. I think that certainly was on his mind. And I think Democrats have to grapple with the fact that this might sell to a portion of the public, and it might sell to even some previous Democratic voters who are on Trump's side now on some of these issues. And they have to figure out a way to sell this to their voters. You know, complicating that a little bit is there is plenty of polling that says, in general, a majority of Americans believe in climate change and want to do something about it.
It's a very risky strategy to reduce your entire foreign policy to this very small number of American voters who want to turn back the clock to the time when coal was a major source of energy in this country.
Coal jobs in America are less. There are less than 100,000 coal jobs in America. That's not just miners. That's everything. The entire industry. You know, it's as if at the time of the automotive revolution, you know, Canada came along and talked about saving blacksmiths who were making horseshoes. I mean, that's what this is like. But it does have an enduring power in the Republican Party. And that's not to say that Democrats should be blasé about those jobs going away, but it is sort of absurd given all of the jobs created by the green revolution and solar and wind power and all the rest to think that, you know, coal is the future.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Getting back to the point you were making earlier about the hardline nationalists in the White House versus the New York globalists, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, represents the globalist wing, and he has been coming under fire in the last week for his own difficulties with Russia.
Yeah, you have this constant seesaw between the Bannon wing and the Kushner wing in this White House, and things got so bad for Bannon in April that many people thought he was going to be fired, and the president, in an on-the-record interview, called him a guy I know. I mean, if you called me a guy you know, I would start looking for a new job, Dorothy.
Yeah.
But he survived. And then Kushner started getting wrapped up in the Russian investigation. I think one thing that's been a benefit for Bannon is he came to the Trump campaign relatively late, right after the convention, when some of the aides that have been tied to the Russia probe were long gone. The one person that remained was Michael Flynn, but as far as we know so far, Bannon was not involved in any of the talks with the Russians during the transition that has become the focus of the FBI probe. Kushner was, right? So Kushner had this relationship with Flynn. He attended at least, you know, two crucial meetings that the FBI is taking a look at during the transition. So all of this, so last Friday, sort of just in the middle of the final meetings in the White House over what to do about the Paris Accord, the news broke that Kushner met with the Russian ambassador and that they discussed some kind of private channel to communicate that would be undetected by American surveillance. Big explosive story that puts Jared Kushner at the center of the FBI's probe about the Trump campaign's connections to the Russians. And I don't necessarily think that Trump would have changed his mind anyway, but the weakening of one of his key, maybe his most important advisors at the very moment he had to make this big decision surely came into play. There are some reports today, but I haven't confirmed this, but NBC was talking this morning that Bannon was actually bragging that Kushner has been weakened.
So you're sort of answering a question I had, which is about why should anyone care about who's up and who's down? This is, you know, the parlor game that you all in yeah. White House press corps like to play. But it matters strategically and it matters in terms of the White House's foreign policy.
I do think you're right about some of the palace intrigue stories are not very helpful in understanding what's going on. But the way to connect them is that personnel is policy. And because Trump has had so many different views on so many different issues and because he doesn't really know much about policy in general, it is important to know who's around him and what they're advising. At the same time, his instincts from what we know about him on something like the Paris Accord are him. They're not. I don't think he's being manipulated by Steve Bannon and other people on this. I think his view, both from a policy perspective and from a political perspective, his instinct is screw foreigners, screw deals with Europeans. I think he is a deep skeptic of climate change. He's called it a hoax in the past. And so I think we can overstate how important it is that Steve Bannon was in a powerful position and Kushner was in a weakened position when this decision came along, because at the end of the day, this is what Trump believes.
You wrote earlier this week online about this sort of shadowy circle just outside the White House, including Roger Stone. And tell us what you had to say about Stone and why they are important, that little group.
So the sort of scoop in that piece was that Trump called Roger Stone the day after Trump tweeted that he hasn't talked to Roger Stone in some time. And the reason why he was denying talking to Stone was twofold. One, it was reported that Stone advised him to fire Comey, and Trump thought that that looked bad because, well, Stone is caught up in the FBI probe, so it's a little unusual that the White House would, one, be talking to someone who's a witness in the case and is the subject of interest to the FBI, and two, that he would be listening to that person when deciding whether to fire the FBI director.
And does this, Ryan, there's been a lot of talk about how Trump could be in legal trouble with some of his tweets, and that he's lying in that tweet.
And this didn't go in the piece, Dorothy, but someone pointed out to me, Roger Stone is going to testify before Congress under oath, and he's going to be asked very specifically about all his contacts, phone calls, strategy memos, whatever else he's had with the White House and with Trump. And we have a record, of course, from Twitter where Trump says, okay, I haven't talked to Roger Stone in some time. But the bigger question is, why is the president calling these people who are witnesses or the subject of an FBI probe?
So I have to ask you about some of the latest news, which is we now have Putin saying that, well, maybe Russian hackers did meddle in the election.
You know, the famous chess player and Putin critic, Garry Kasparov, he's a very close Putin watcher and, you know, obviously a longtime critic, who tweeted something very interesting about this. He said that this is classic Putin. What he does initially with a story about Russian intervention somewhere is deny it. Then he says, oh, what's the big deal? Then he says, okay, yes, that happened. And then eventually he brags about it to the Russian public about what a great Russian success this was.
But what is he going at here in terms of his relationship with Trump?
I think he has to wonder whether the whole, you know, yes, he helped Trump get elected, but is he actually going to get any concessions from Trump? There's reporting today that during the transition and the early days of the administration, that there really was a plan from the Trump administration to kill the sanctions that Obama put in place on December 29th in response to Russia's election meddling. It now seems, policy-wise, that it's difficult for the Trump administration to do anything that seems like they are rewarding Putin because of all these controversies. So at some point, I suppose Putin has to think, well, maybe there are no concessions to be won from Trump, but there's further damage he can do to the United States and just sort of continue stirring the pot.
And that brings us to next Thursday. James Comey will be testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee. That day is already being anticipated as on the level of Watergate-style hearings. What do you anticipate?
Comey is we know his public presentations are well thought out, and they can be devastating. I mean, just look at when he decided not to indict Hillary Clinton or any of her aides, but he decided to go public with the results of the investigation. And he was unsparing in his personal criticism of her and what she did wrong. So I think if you look at that model and you consider that in this case, it's Comey himself, whose reputation the White House attempted to tarnish, I would expect a pretty powerful case. And there are, you know, two big questions that senators will have for him. One, what does he think of the notion that there's an obstruction of justice case against the president? And Comey's answer on that will be extremely revealing. And then two, what can he actually say about the contemporaneous memos he wrote and handed over to his colleagues at the FBI that apparently recorded conversations he had with Trump that he believed were inappropriate, including Trump telling him to essentially end the investigation of Michael Flynn.
Okay, thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Ryan Lizza reports from Washington for The New Yorker and is a commentator for CNN. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Dubuff for newyorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.